Are child protection service agencies doing more harm than good?
Because definitions and understandings of child abuse and neglect are so vague and broad and discretionary, parents can't always be sure. You know, they could feel like they're doing all of the right things, so to speak. But then there's one judgmental person that will say, well, you don't have the food you need to feed your child. Let me call CPS. And so a lot of poverty and adversity related concerns end up getting sent to CPS. And in that context, parents who are facing poverty and adversity aren't sure how open or how forthcoming they can and should be with the very systems that are supposed to be helping them.
That's Kelly Fong. We talk with her about her book, Investigating Families, Motherhood in the Shadow of Child Protection Services. Then we replay part of our 2022 interview with Emmy Neatfield, whose memoir, Acceptance, is about how she transcended the traumas of childhood abuse and the foster care system. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The dreaded sound of a knock on the door strikes fear into the hearts of many mothers, signaling a visit from Child Protection Services, or CPS. In recent decades, such encounters have become all too common, almost always targeting poor families, including minorities. One out of every three children nationwide and half of Black children will encounter CPS during their childhood. Is it really protecting children from abuse or punishing poverty? In her book, Investigating Families, Kelly Fong explores the inner workings of CPS, shedding light on the experiences of families caught in its grasp. She shows how the reliance on CPS, an institution focused on parental wrongdoing, and authorized to separate families, structures the response to adversity around monitoring, evaluating, and correcting marginalized mothers. This approach undermines mothers' feelings of safety and often discourages them from getting the help they need. Kelly Fong teaches sociology at the University of California, Irvine. Her research focuses on poverty, inequality, social policy, children, and family life. Investigating Families is her first book. Kelly Fong, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
This book, Investigating Families, the subtitle is Motherhood in the Shadow of Child Protective Services, which we'll call CPS from now on. Usually the focus in this space is on the children. Why did you want to focus on mothers and motherhood?
Yes. So I started this work actually by speaking with mothers in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was living. And they just told me sort of story after story about the way that their care for their children was structured by this system, sometimes the system that they hadn't even had contact with yet. And this is a system, as you say, that is, pretty laser focused on children, but in trying to do what's best for children, the system is also intervening with parents, primarily mothers. So they're investigating, over 3 million families each year for following allegations of suspected child abuse and neglect. Most of those investigations are investigations of mothers and mothering. And so even as child welfare agencies, even as CPS is supposedly looking out for the best interests of children, their interventions are really with mothers. And so it's mothers' experiences that I wanted to center in the book.
And you found that mothers' experiences are profoundly destabilizing to them. Give us a broad outlines of that before we get into some of the details.
So for low-income mothers and mothers of color in particular, who are very highly exposed to CPS and the prospect of CPS intervention, so many of them, if they haven't had contact themselves, they've had friends or neighbors or relatives who have been investigated by this system. And it's a system where there's a lot of discretion So people all around you can call you in. There are people who are legally mandated to report if they suspect anything going on. So you can think about, you know, your child's teacher, your child's pediatrician, your own therapist, you know, your own mother or your ex-boyfriend. All of these people around you can turn you in. And the threshold is not too high to call something in. Anyone at all can suspect something for any reason. It can be a misunderstanding. It can be just sort of a judgment about what's appropriate parenting. They can make this call. And that can often launch this very intrusive investigation where a state agent is coming to your home and asking you all manner of questions about things going on in your home. They're digging up documents, interviewing others in, you know, that you might be connected to, and so on. And CPS is an agency that is framing itself as an agency that is looking to help families. At the same time, because of their focus on abuse and neglect in particular, it's an agency that is focused on what parents are doing wrong. And so they are hyper-focused on the risks that parents might pose potentially to their children. And they're also an agency with the power to remove children from home. So no other agency can kind of step in and say, we are taking your children for some undefined time to some undefined place. And that prospect is really beyond terrifying to families. And so when you have the situation where anyone at all can call you in and a state agent who has the power to remove your children can come in and speak with you, your child custody is on the line, your motherhood is on the line for mothers, again, predominantly low-income mothers and mothers of color who are accustomed to systems just kind of batting them around. In that kind of environment, you come to recognize that, you know, your motherhood is not necessarily something that you have control over. It's something that some undefined other authority is in charge of.
Right. And so we will go more deeply into that. But first, just introduce us to one of your characters, Jasmine. Tell us how she experiences destabilization.
So Jasmine is a young Black and Puerto Rican mother that I met in New Haven a few years back. And she was the mother of a two-year-old, a toddler. In the book, everyone has a pseudonym. So they're real people. I didn't change details, but they have fake names to protect their privacy. So I call her son, her two-year-old son, Gabriel. And I met Jasmine when I was shadowing with her CPS investigator. So CPS had received a call that she had physically disciplined her son in the presence of her housing case manager. And so CPS decided to go out that night to her apartment and speak with her about this incident and figure out what was going on. And even in that first interaction, it was quite apparent that this was a very jarring experience for her. So she had been meeting with her housing case manager, you know, pretty much weekly for the past 2 years. So she'd really developed a relationship and some trust with this person that she felt was trying to help her. And so to have this person, you know, then turn around and essentially call her a suspected child abuser really felt like a profound betrayal for her. So she was very upset at the housing case manager and understandably very terrified of what could happen to her and her son. So she had been in foster care herself as a young person. And so she knew sort of firsthand how these types of situations could snowball into, you know, years and years in care, jumping around between different placements, that kind of thing. And so when she described it to me in an interview later, she said it was almost like, you know, that experience was sort of flashing through her mind. Right? She sort of saw that happening to her son. And this was extremely, extremely terrifying and anxiety-inducing, as you can imagine. And so even as the investigator walked out that day, you know, recognized, you know, this is a mom who needs some help. This is a mom who, you know, is not severely abusing her child. Her child does not need to be removed right now. That's typical. So over 80% of cases, the agency determines that there isn't enough evidence to confirm abuse or neglect. And in like 95% of cases, kids actually remain home after that investigation. And so we might say, well, this is a great outcome. She avoided the worst. She avoided the things she was afraid of. CPS made the right decision. They sort of did this investigation and determined that nothing further was going on, but it's great that we checked it out. Nevertheless, this was, as you say, like very destabilizing for her. She was very upset with her housing case manager, as I mentioned. She was very anxious during this period about what could happen, what would happen. She wasn't sure, you know, who she could trust moving forward. She felt pressured into different services that were being recommended that she wasn't sure, you know, would be the best fit for her. And just overall, there was this feeling of like, as I said, you know, someone else being in charge, right? She said, now I have this other person, you know, it was a white person, a white investigator coming in and telling me what I have to do. And I know that I have to sort of jump through every hoop, do what they say I have to do, or else my child will be removed. And so it's not a process that's empowering, right, to her and her parenting. It's a process that really, despite the best intentions of the investigator and despite his friendly and professional nature, it's an experience that really kind of stripped her of that autonomy.
Yeah, and this is really kind of the best case scenario. First of all, as you say, and the investigator himself was professional, he was compassionate, he was sensitive to her needs. This is in a state which is a democratic state and has more services and resources than many other states that really have far more draconian approaches to social services. She did not lose her kid. And yet this still was a profoundly upsetting, even bordering on traumatizing experience for Jasmine. What is the impact, and I don't mean a positive impact, of even this best case scenario on parenting itself, broader than Jasmine? How does, you know, even people, parents, knowing that there are services out there that they can access if they need them, how does the existence of this system change the way they view parenting and how they do it?
Yeah. So I, as I kind of alluded to before, started this project interviewing parents in a different state, in Rhode Island, regardless of whether they had been investigated. And what struck me there was the way that the system in communities that are highly exposed to this, to child protective services, the way that these communities are, that parents in these communities are highly aware of CPS and what CPS can do and how you can be reported to CPS even before you have any contact, any firsthand experience. And so you know, I don't want to overstate the case. You know, for some parents, especially parents that I met who were, you know, using substances, for instance, facing addiction issues, you know, there was this sort of all-encompassing fear of CPS from the start, constant. You have to watch every single move you do. But for most other parents that I met, you know, it's not that they think about CPS and are afraid of CPS with every single little thing. So they, you know, love going to school and talking to their kids' teachers, and they, you know, are excited about the opportunity to talk with their doctors about how their kids are doing. But I think about it as sort of this additional like cognitive load or this additional parenting tax where with every interaction that you're having, and especially with these so-called mandated reporters, there's a part of you, so you're thinking about what's best for your kid, but there's sort of a part of you that also has to be thinking about, you know, how will this person read this interaction? What are the stakes of engaging in a particular way or not? So for, let's say, affluent white parents, you know, of course, they're concerned about judgment as well. You know, you don't want to tell the doctor that you feed your child only, you know, soda and candy. So they're worried about judgment as well. But the stakes are just different, right? The stakes are different if what's at stake here is, you know, your child's ability to stay with you, right? Your child custody, your sort of family integrity. And so this would come up in a lot of little moments where, you know, mothers would share things like, you know, I don't necessarily want to tell my doctor about my homelessness because those are the kinds of things that can lead to a report if they're misunderstood. You know, I don't want to tell the Head Start that, you know, sometimes I get really stressed out with my child. I'm not sure if I should go to the hospital if I'm experiencing domestic violence, for instance. Because definitions and understandings of child abuse and neglect are so vague and broad and discretionary, parents can't always be sure. You know, they could feel like they're doing all of the right things, so to speak. But then there's one judgmental person that will say, well, you don't have the food you need to feed your child. Let me call CPS. And so a lot of poverty and adversity related concerns end up getting sent to CPS. And in that context, parents who are facing poverty and adversity aren't sure how open or how forthcoming they can and should be with the very systems that are supposed to be helping them, right? So it's exactly the schools and the doctors and the mental health providers that we want to be hearing about the struggles and the challenges that families are facing so that they can help families work through those challenges or refer them to available resources. But we've set up this situation where, you know, parents are afraid to open up about those kinds of things because they worry about the intervention of this threatening agency with the power to remove their children.
We're talking with sociologist Kelly Fong about her book, Investigating Families, Motherhood in the Shadow of Child Protective Services. Yeah, exactly. In fact, what you're saying is that it disincentivizes people to access the help that they need. And also then the point that you make is the kind of the vagueness of the rules. And one would say, as you do say in the book, that a lot of the notion of maltreatment, I mean, not in all cases, obviously, but in some cases is in fact socially, culturally, and structured, created, or even created by class. And I'm thinking, for example, my granddaughter, who now is, you know, a college student, but back when she was a little kid, lived in Brooklyn, right in front in an apartment fronting a park where there was a playground. And she went out to the playground every day. And as she got older, say 10, 11, her mother would let her go out to the playground. You know, they were right there. The playground was right in front of the door to play with the other kids, you know. And when I was a kid, I spent most of my time playing with other kids unsupervised. And if you go to Europe, the kids are in general playing together unsupervised. And in fact, many people say that's much healthier for social development. Yet her mother was threatened by other mothers in the neighborhood who said, your child shouldn't be out there. And if I see you doing it again, I'm going to report you to CPS. Mm-hmm. And that was not even mandated reporters. So talk about that whole, it's almost like, you know, it's living in a fishbowl.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as you say, you know, there are standards for child rearing that are socially and culturally specific, right? So we, the society, essentially gets to decide what we think is a danger to children and what is not. And, you know, you see this in, you know, Texas when you had the Governor Greg Abbott directing CPS to be investigating the parents of transgender children who were seeking health care for them, gender affirming health care for them, right? The ways that this category or this designation can really be weaponized in various ways to go after families that society doesn't want, that society wants to punish or police in various ways. And on this example of kids, you know, once they've reached a certain age and maturity level playing outside unsupervised, I think this is a prime example of the way that different perspectives on, it's a prime example of the way that different perspectives on child rearing can sort of, that there can be some reasonable disagreement or reasonable different perspectives in terms of what's best for children. There's actually an organization, Let Grow, that is working on this issue in particular, and working to ensure that, you know, allowing children some reasonable independence isn't labeled a child abuse or child neglect case. I think that corporal punishment is another one of these gray areas that people disagree on. So Jasmine was reported to CPS for smacking her kid's hand. And there's research that connects this to negative child outcomes. So it's not necessarily that it's benign. At the same time, most U.S. parents of toddlers spank their toddlers. And so it's a relatively normative practice, and there it's a racialized practice as well, with Black parents in particular talking about how this is part of the disciplinary practices that they use, that some families use, to prepare their children for sort of growing up in a racist society.
Yes, exactly. Because as you point out in the book, this was an authority. Her child was kind of, you know, hitting the housing manager. So, and authorities who are in a position of policing and control over somebody, or potential control, can be acutely dangerous to the life and health of Black children, especially Black boys. And one of the other things that really struck me is that you said that, you know, it's almost a mirror of what happens to Black and Latino or other marginalized communities, you know, indigenous communities as well, to the men. Men are funneled to prison. Women are funneled into the child protective services system. Say more about that.
Yeah, there are really these two parallel systems operating in primarily low-income communities and often low-income communities of color. And the wonderful sociologist and legal scholar Dorothy Roberts has been calling attention to this for years as well. The ways that the child welfare system, CPS, it's even been called, you know, family policing by some advocates, right, to reflect the policing work that it does in these same communities where men, young Black men, are being policed by criminal legal system actors. So on the one hand, you have this more, people are more readily able to see it as a policing and punishment agency, you know, stopping and frisking lots of young men of color for sort of various infractions, you know, whether that's even things like looking suspicious or hanging out with the wrong people. And at the same time, you have this other system, CPS, which positions itself as a more helping system, a more support-oriented system, but that is nevertheless investigating, sending state agents out to investigate many, many, many parents, primarily low parents and parents of color in particular, for these kinds of relatively minor situations that raise the alarm of someone for whatever reason. So just the same way we see, you know, people making judgments and calling the police on someone they think looks, you know, sketchy in some way, someone doing something they don't like in a public space, you know, the same thing happens to women with respect to CPS. You could have, you know, a jealous ex that is just upset with you for whatever reason and decides to place a call. Or, you know, something I sometimes saw in the research was, you know, schools that are having a lot of conflicts with parents, for instance, and the school really thinks that the child needs, you know, X intervention, and the parents are maybe thinking that something else should happen. And so the schools use CPS as this tool, this kind of stick, to either teach the parents a lesson or kind of bring them into line. And so it's really in both cases, this expression of power and this you know, system of social control.
And so, Kelly Fong, in this book, Investigating Families, you are really focusing in many ways on the system itself and how it reflects broader inequalities in the society itself. And you said 95% of the cases, children do remain in the home. But what about that last 5%? What happens when CPS does, quote unquote, substantiate what they are calling abuse or neglect, and do take away children? Tell us a story of Christine?
Yes, Christina is featured in the book. Yes. So again, this is a book that's about mothers and mothers' experiences. So although many of the mothers that I spoke with had experienced as children, and although I was able to observe a lot of what children were experiencing, I just want to first say up front that the book doesn't specifically feature children's perspectives on this, which would be, of course, an essential piece of it. For mothers, I will say the experience is absolutely just crushing, just the most devastating experience that one could imagine. And, you know, we could say, well, that's a cost that we're willing to bear to ensure children's safety. And in some instances, you know, maybe that might be the case. But I think that there are ways that even when children are removed, the way in which the system goes about things just leaves mothers feeling like they don't have any meaningful say in the process, like everyone is against them, working against them, and really just leaves them disillusioned with the broader state apparatus and society overall. And so Christina's is a case that I think it's fairly clear to me that removal might not even have been necessary. So there's a large portion of cases, I think, where CPS is opting to remove kids that maybe some alternative intervention could have prevented. So she got into an altercation with a checkout clerk. The police were called. She didn't want to engage with the police. And so sort of on both accounts, both Christina's and the police report, which I also read, you know, she was resisting a little bit. They didn't like that. And so they handcuffed her and took her to jail. And her 2 or 3 year old son was with her at the time. And because she goes to jail, they have to figure out what to do with this toddler. And they could have just called a relative and said, hey, can you watch this child while his mother is in jail? But they got CPS involved. And once that door was opened, sort of it's a really difficult snowball to stop. So CPS was then digging into absolutely everything and instituting all of these requirements that were that she had to complete before they decided that her son could come home. And so although her criminal charges were dropped pretty immediately, the CPS case really stayed with her. So that's an example of a case where, you know, we could imagine a different outcome. And there were other cases where, you know, I think that the, you know, children were in maybe a little bit more substantially challenging conditions. And even in those cases, in all of these cases, the mothers that I spoke to talked about feeling disregarded in court, feeling like even though their own attorneys weren't advocating for them, you know, their perspectives were being dismissed at many turns. And so even in these situations where we think we are intervening to place kids in a different environment to ensure their safety, it's still a process that is extraordinarily disempowering for mothers. And I think that this matters not only because these mothers are people too, and they deserve, you know, dignity and the ability to have their perspectives heard. It also matters for children and child well-being. So most children end up returning home to their families, children who are placed into foster care. And the mothers whose children are removed, they often end up caring for other relatives, like other grandchildren and nieces and nephews and so on. And so what are we doing when we're giving these caregivers and these people this just highly disillusioning experience with the state and with these institutions that they might have been told or might have been sold to them as institutions that were looking out for them and their families?
So in full disclosure, I was for about 10 years in the 1990s. I was a clinical social worker. It's kind of where I learned to interview people. And I worked with families who almost always were involved with CPS. These were largely poor, low-income, often Puerto Rican families in Western Massachusetts. And at that time, the emphasis was on keeping families together. And the way you would do that, if the families were involved, were brought into the system after investigation, the way to do that was with intensive family intervention, which meant spending, you know, quite a few hours a week right in the home. And at the time, I thought, well, this is great. You know, this is what people need is good models and help in the home and relieve the stress of having kids. But after reading your book, I got a different sense of it, that this also was profoundly destabilizing and disempowering. So talk a little bit about that, and then what is the best way to both protect children and families?
Yeah, so first, you know, thank you for the years of work that you did on behalf of children and families. And, you know, I think it's, you know, there's no one size fits all. So for some families, they really appreciate those kinds of in-home services. They learn a lot. I talked to parents who just gushed about the experiences that they had and those kinds of services and the way that their clinicians were really supporting them and their families' needs. So that's really wonderful. And to the extent that we can provide that kind of service that families are interested in and that's helping them, perhaps through a different route than through this threatening agency that's basically saying, if you don't do this, we're going to remove your children, then I think that's wonderful. Other parents experience these services as burdensome, right? It's more appointments that mean you maybe have to take time off work or have to reorganize other things in your life to attend. Maybe they didn't find them that helpful. So Jasmine was referred to a set of intensive services that she just didn't feel were going to help her or were going to change her mind on her marijuana use. And these services can also be seen sometimes as like another arm of CPS, right? So they're also surveilling you. They're also in your home and ready in parents' minds sometimes to just pick up the phone and call you back in. So you sort of have to tiptoe. For some parents, they felt they had to tiptoe around these folks as well. You know, you couldn't be sure if they were on your side. And so, you know, I think in those instances, it's not just we professional class know what's best for you, and this is the service that we've decided that you should participate in, but really giving families options to decide, you know, what works for them. You know, maybe it's not an intensive in-home service. You know, maybe there's something else that would work for them, and incorporating their perspectives into some of these, you know, program and service designs so that, you know, you don't need that CPS saying do this or else, right? You have families that actively want to engage in these services because they are actually, they see the ways that they can be helpful to their families. You know, that's what we want, right? We don't want families to feel like they're being coerced into these things. We want them to be deciding that this is going to be useful to them. And for what it's worth, I think this is what we see with privileged families, right? If you go to a therapist and you say, well, this therapist isn't working for me, just our styles, this isn't helping me. You know, you have the prerogative to choose someone different and someone that will, that you feel is a better fit. And so I think it's opening up those kinds of options and those kind of genuine choices to all families. At the same time, I think that the challenges that families face are, you know, not limited to the kind of clinical or therapeutic challenges. So for the vast majority of families entangled in the system, the root of many of the needs that they have is poverty, is adversity, and all of the things that kind of are wrapped into that, whether that's, you know, systemic racism or material hardships of various kinds, homelessness. Those are the things that even if families are, you know, experiencing stress and other things, like often those are the things at the root of those stressors. And so, you know, I think in this field, the focus has primarily been on these kinds of family level interventions, like what is the service we can provide to the family? Like what is the social worker that we can send out to fix what's going on and sort of shift their mindsets and shift their behaviors? But I think that we should think about child protection work much more broadly. So there's kind of growing research base now connecting all sorts of economic supports to reductions in child maltreatment, reductions in child welfare involvement. And so those kinds of things, you know, things like the enhanced child tax credit or, you know, childcare subsidies, you know, investments in things like public parks, public libraries, like we don't think about the like child protection implications of those things, but they really are child protection interventions, just the same as, you know, these kind of more intensive clinical interventions are. And so I would like to see more investment in that kind of work, those kinds of initiatives on the front end to, you know, even prevent families from having to come into contact with the system at all.
Well, exactly. I mean, isn't it true that there were problems with the pandemic in other ways, but the decrease in child poverty was really striking. And then taken away after the pandemic had, you know, simmered down to a lower level, thanks to the vote of every single senator on the GOP side and to senators on the Democratic side, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, and the fact that Joe Manchin also blocked the child tax, the same kinds of supports in what was originally the Build Back Better bill and then became the Inflation Reduction Act, minus all those. I mean, the point there was that infrastructure, for example, is also social infrastructure, and how critical that that is. Unfortunately, we seem to be going in the opposite direction. And that's why a book like this, which really focuses on the child protection system within the larger system of our society, I think is so illuminating and so important. Investigating Families, Motherhood in the Shadow of Child Protective Services. Kelly Fung, we just barely scratch the surface. There is so much more in this book. It's really fascinating read, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thanks so much. This is great.
Kelly Fung teaches sociology at the University of California, Irvine. Investigating Families is out from Princeton University Press. Next up, we talk with somebody who survived parental abuse and the abuse of the CPS system. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the fall of 2022, we spoke with Emmy Neatfield about her powerful memoir, Acceptance. It chronicles her struggles as a teenager and young adult to rise above the poverty and abuse she suffered as a child, despite a child protection system that was anything but protective of children. Here's an extended excerpt from that conversation. Emmy Neatfield, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was just a wonderful book, Acceptance. I really enjoyed it. And it has so much in it, of which we will only cover a small portion. But I want to first ask you about the title, Acceptance. It really could cover a number of different meanings.
Yes, it can cover a lot of meanings, and I hope that for readers it does. The title first came to me when I was thinking about some stuff that happens early on in the book when I was 14 and I was in this institution for troubled teenagers. And we received this therapy called dialectical behavioral therapy, which is very popular, but at the time I really hated it because it focused on this concept of radical acceptance. So I had these adults telling me that I was miserable because I was refusing to accept my situation. And they framed acceptance as kind of the cure to suffering. And at the time, I thought, this is ridiculous. I have real problems in my life, which I would like to solve. So I chose the title Acceptance at first as kind of a rejection of that idea. And over time, through living the story and writing the book, it did come to take on many more meanings,
including being accepted into a society very different than the one that you grew up in, being accepted into college. But this whole notion of acceptance as part of what I used to be a clinical social worker, and I used to call it the therapy as punishment. You know, the notion that you have to accept things that are really unacceptable, especially for children, applied to children, I think is incredibly inappropriate. A central theme of the book is just how broken our system of child protection is in this country. Talk a little bit about that brokenness.
After my parents divorced, when I was around 11, I moved in with my mom, who had full custody of me. And she suffered from hoarding disorder and compulsive shopping. And this meant that our house was basically inhabitable. Our bathtub was completely filled with peanut butter jars and dirty laundry, and we often couldn't shower because of that. And we had mice everywhere in our home. And my physical and mental health began to deteriorate, and my mom took me to see therapists. And I think this is what any parent in her situation would do given the chance. But, you know, instead of looking at the problems at home, which I was talking about, I was medicated. And I asked therapist after therapist, like, you know, please just come see how we're living. But no one came. And instead, I ended up being hospitalized repeatedly and eventually sent to this institution where the journey of acceptance really starts.
You know, the so-called helping professionals who became involved in your case, or actually you found out later, much later, were very well aware of your mother's illness, but you were the one who effectively was pathologized.
It was a really, in hindsight as an adult, I can see that it was a really difficult situation for them because, you know, I was a child and because of that, they could do anything to me. They could give me medication. They could send me to this locked facility, send me to foster care. But because my mom was an adult and she was like me, a white adult, she was college educated, she owned her own home. So doctors really, they really gave her the benefit of the doubt and they really hesitated to get Child Protective Services involved. Even when I went into foster care a little bit later, I still did not have a case with Child Protective Services. There was no, it was deemed to be for my health, that I was too sick to live at home.
So talk a little bit more about that. Child Protective Services, I mean, in some ways, given how dysfunctional the Child Protective Services system is, and before when I use that term, I meant it in a kind of a larger term, not just the foster care sense, but it is so broken that it, in some way, they were partly trying to protect you. Is that right?
Absolutely. There was one afternoon when I was 13 and my social worker, I had been assigned a social worker when at the psych ward, and she specialized in troubled teenage girls who were deemed to be so sick that they were their own problems. And there was this afternoon when my mom was at work and she came to the house and she asked me, you know, will you let me in? And my home had one rule, and that was do not let anyone in, especially if they're from the government. And so even though I was desperate to escape, I didn't let her in because I knew my mom would never forgive me and that I would be taken away. My mom would be stripped of her power and her house would probably be condemned. And years later, I was talking to my social worker about it. I was interviewing her for this book, and she said that she was glad that I hadn't let her in and that my predictions were probably right and that it probably would not have been what was best for me to get the Child Protective Services involved.
It's really a portrait of a child who is abandoned by everyone, especially the people who are supposed to be there for her. And that included your dad. Talk a little bit about your dad and how he absconded from your life, I guess you could say.
My parents were married when I was growing up. We were evangelical Christian, very religious. And then when I was in fourth grade, one day my dad picked me up from school and told me, I'm changing my name to Michelle, as I call her in the book. And she came out as trans. And in many ways, it was a good thing for her. In many ways, it was a good thing for me. But this was Minnesota in the early 2000s. No one really understood what was going on. Our church did not agree. My mom did not agree. And it started a very contentious divorce process. And at the end of a year-long custody battle, Michelle lost custody. My mom got full custody and Michelle moved away across the country. And throughout middle school and high school, like I did try to make contact with her and there was some very, very limited contact. But I never really saw her again. And there were some reasons for this that I learned much later as an adult, but as a child, it was very, very opaque to me. And so I just really felt abandoned.
You know, what really comes to the fore is the incredible self-involvement. I mean, one could even say narcissism, certainly in the case of your mother, but even of your father as well. I mean, so self-involved that they could not see you as a child, and as you just said, I mean, you didn't really know what was going on, and yet, in some ways, you were very precocious, and I mean that as someone who had real survival skills, who had that kind of grit and resilience, in quotation marks, that are so celebrated these days, and yet you have a very complicated relationship to those words, grit and resilience. Talk about yourself in that context.
Grit was an idea that I saw all around me as being the ideal. Going back to the treatment center where I was locked up when I was 14, we were told that we had to, like, no matter what had happened to us, we were the only people who were responsible for our feelings. Like, it didn't matter what had been done and who did it. It was just all on our shoulders to kind of pick ourselves up and move forward, even though we were, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. And this idea of resilience really, it seemed to follow me everywhere that I went. And I think, as you mentioned, I did have this kind of innate sense of knowing what I needed and sticking with the goals that I had in order to get myself out. But that wasn't usually what people meant when they were talking about resilience. Instead, I encountered this idea of, like, the perfect child who had been through horrible, terrible things and was completely unaffected by it. And this became especially clear when I was applying to college. And I was forced in my college applications essays to talk about what happened during high school, which was being in foster care for a while. At the time, I was sleeping in my car and on friends' sofas. And I had to lay out those facts for them and show them that not only had I survived, but that I had been made stronger for having those things happen to me.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Emmy Neatfield about her powerful memoir, Acceptance. It chronicles her struggles as a teenager and young adult to rise above the poverty and abuse she suffered as a child, despite a child protection system that was anything but protective of children. Yeah, in fact, you talk about how there are very few ways to acceptably ask for help. And this was part of it. I mean, here again, the acceptance, we're talking about so few ways to be acceptable as someone who is deserving of help. So talk about that. What are the different factors that make you deserving, and what impact did it have on your sense of self, of who you were, to have this ideal held out there that you knew you had to conform to if you were going to get what you needed?
One of the clearest examples of what problems were okay to have and which ones weren't was when I applied to this scholarship called the Horatio Alger Association of Distinguished Americans. And people might be familiar with Horatio Alger as the author of a bunch of 19th century novels with young boys who, like, really pull themselves up by their bootstraps and I exemplify, like, rags to riches stories. And so this scholarship actually had a checklist of adversities that I could complete. And it listed things like foster care, homelessness, parental drug addiction, incarceration. And I noticed that, you know, there was this really long list and there was one box for abuse. And there was nothing there for sexual assault, which is a really common experience for everyone, but especially for people who have been in foster care or who don't have families that are protecting them. And that really opened my eyes to what was going to be okay to talk about and what kind of things that happened in my past that I should be ashamed of or that could kind of disqualify me from getting the help that I really craved and needed.
And how did that impact your sense of self? I mean, it would require somebody of incredible, almost preternatural maturity not to be affected by pushing you into, squeezing you into a box of what's acceptable trauma and what's not.
It was brutal. When I was asking people for help with the college application essays, the advice I kept getting was just be yourself. And this advice, it didn't make me feel better. It made me feel worse because there was this real conflation of your college application reflects who you are as a person. And so I felt like if there are things that have happened in my life that I'm not going to write about in that application, it means that I'm bad. And, you know, I had found a lot of solace in writing all through high school. I wrote novels and then I wrote personal essays. And I loved being able to like to share my experiences on my own terms and to like write about the complexity of situations and, you know, those very specific memories that we have of like the way my mom's hair smelled or the way the grass in her yard looked. And in the process of having to tell this trauma porn story for colleges, all of that was stripped away and it felt extremely dehumanizing.
Trauma porn.
Trauma porn.
That's a great expression. And especially because your mother's hair smelled like mouse pee. I mean, I get it. You don't want to put that in a college application essay.
Yeah. And I started writing acceptance in high school. Like I wrote the initial things that would become this book because it was so shocking to me that millions of high schoolers are going through this process. And it seemed to change me in a way. Like I went in one way and I came out a different way. And I thought this must reflect something bigger that's happening in society to be requiring this of teenagers who don't have their identity really in place yet, to be demanding of them that they like tell a group of strangers, here's who I am, here's my deepest secrets, but only in a way that's acceptable to you.
You know, another thing that really struck me, Emmy Neatfield, in this wonderful memoir, Acceptance, is how you talk about the class and even racial. I mean, because you do see you had some privilege because you were white, but you were poor and you were subject to an incredible amount of discouragement and, in fact, of active obstruction in trying to realize your dreams. I mean, that's one of the things that surprised me the most. I mean, I would think that somebody like you who was very studious, really bent on getting into college and getting into college early so that you could get some control over your life, were so relentlessly discouraged from it. Talk a little bit about that process and why do you think that happened?
This type of discouragement really started when I was at the residential treatment center and I started studying for standardized tests. And the staff there, they decided that it was inappropriate for me to be reading ACT math problems, or even for me to be reading any book that wasn't teen fiction. And they confiscated my books one afternoon. And they really phrased it as like, this is for your own good. Like, you have problems that you need to be dealing with, and anything intellectual is an escape. And I thought, of course it's an escape. I mean, I'm stuck here in this building with barred windows. Like, I want to get out both mentally and physically and have a different life. But I think that there was so much negativity in part because the odds were low. Even though both of my parents went to college and my mom was really obsessed with a childhood dream she had about going to Stanford, the type of situations that I found myself in, it was not common for teenagers to be going to a four-year university, let alone graduating. Later, when I was interviewing my social worker for the book, she told me that in 30 years, she didn't know about a single client who had gone to college at all.
Except you.
Except for me.
But even so, wouldn't you think that they would then jump in with both feet to try to help you find your dream?
Yeah, that is the big, to me, that's the biggest missed opportunity of, you know, we're talking about systems here that are very complicated and where there's often like very few ways to help. But I was a teenager saying, this is my dream and I'll do anything to get it. And I do think some of the adults, they were really trying to protect me. Like my foster mother, she really believed that my ambition was causing my depression. Yeah. And I was saying, you know, I'm in foster care, right? I can't live with my mom. In foster care, I wasn't allowed to spend time alone with other teenagers. So I was basically barred from normal friendship. It was not a good situation. And it wasn't, you know, no matter what she had done, it would not have been. But that she thought, you know, if you can just relax and watch television, then you can enjoy your life today. Which for me was preposterous.
Yeah, especially since they were, you know, this was a household when you brought an art history book home that had a picture of Michelangelo's David. They were shocked at the pornography you were bringing home.
Yeah, it was a different, and that's one of the unfortunate things that happens when you have children placed into the homes of strangers, where we did not have, you know, we were both white Protestant Minnesotans, but we didn't have a lot of similar interests or values. And that bubbled up in ways that were sometimes tragic and sometimes absurd. And in hindsight, I hope really funny.
Emmy Neatfield talking to us in 2022 about her memoir, Acceptance. Father's Day is coming up, and I have just the book to recommend. Like Father, Like Son. It's from the prolific award-winning children's book author Leslie Newman, with charming illustrations by A.G. Ford. Featuring fathers who are strong in a gentle way, it's a celebration of what fathers and sons do together, like cooking, camping, and gardening. It also models what a good dad is like. Here's a brief excerpt, just to give you a flavor of the book. So the first page shows a father at a sewing machine with his young son beside him knitting. My daddy knits, my daddy sews. He makes us both fantastic clothes. Next page is my daddy cooks, my daddy bakes. He serves me the most yummy cakes. But then on another page, we go a little bit deeper. When I fell down and scraped my knee, my daddy took good care of me. He knelt and looked me in the eye. It's okay, bud, he said, to cry. And then another page. One day when I was feeling blue, my daddy knew just what to do. He brought me to our favorite chair and rocked me and my teddy bear. So that's just a little taste from the book Like Father, Like Son by best-selling author Leslie Newman. It's out from Abrams. And a happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.